Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:32 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is February 4th. I've had a question about the inverted yield curve. I thought I would kick off with that because I think it's particularly relevant because we've had such an impressive rebound on Wall Street and we've had a succession now of equally sized reactions despite the fact that geopolitical tensions have been rising in January with the assassination of an Iranian general in Iraq. And then you've got the coronavirus, which is scaring people left and right, and yet the market continues higher. There are a couple of different points about the yield curve inversion. Now, some people look at the 10-year minus the 3-month, and some people look at the 10-year minus the 2-year. I generally tend to look at the 10-year minus the 2-year because it has fewer variation. The 10-year minus the 3-month tends to be more volatile. But one of the most important points is that when you do get an inverted yield curve, it has a long lead time. And because of the long lead time, what generally happens, there is seems to be a pretty predictable way in which people start to think about it. The first is they panic. So you get a little bit of a sell-off. And we've had the little bit of a sell-off. The first inversion of the 10-year minus the 3-month was in March, and the 10-year minus the 2-year inverted in August. And we can zoom in and simply look at what happened then. Well, we had pullbacks. And there was a general period of ranging in the region of the upper side of this almost 2-year consolidation. So we had that part of it. We also had that back in 2006, and we also had it in 1998. We had pullbacks associated with the first inversion of the yield curve. Well, because people, first you get the yield curve inversion, then you get a little mild pullback, and then the central bank starts to ease, but they don't ease aggressively because there's no real need to. There isn't a real indication just yet that there is going to be a recession. So they first ease and then they start to tighten. And by tightening following the yield curve, then that starts to restrict liquidity. And by restricting liquidity, it starts to put pressure on the most over-levered participants in the market. Back in the late 1990s, it was the tech companies. In 2007, it was the banks and the mortgage lenders in the USA. Arguably, today, it is going to be the corporations that are in the lowest investment grade rating that won't be able to cover their debts in the event of an economic downturn, or it's going to be the private equity firms and the venture capitalists that are going to see their significant investments in startup companies literally evaporate. Those are where the risks reside today. And of course, that's before we even begin to think about the bubbly environment that we have in China and what kind of a medium-term effect the coronavirus could have on their economy and what the ramifications are of having bought growth in the economy with debt over the course of the last decade. That's going to be a significant question for the next recession. Now, obviously, so we know what the ramifications are. So does the Federal Reserve. That's one of the reasons why this cycle is different. Because generally, we know that this is obviously something that David talked about really quite a lot, but it's particularly relevant at this point, and it is that bull markets do not die of old age. They are assassinated by central banks. That's what happened in 1999-2000. There was a 54% advance from the initial inversion of the yield curve. We had an extraordinary bubble in the tech sector. The NASDAQ went up multiples in 1998 and 1999. The S&P 500 only went up 54%. The NASDAQ went up a lot more than that. Then in 2006 and 2007, we had an incredible move in the commodities sector. But The S&P 500 went up about 25% following the first inversion. Well, so far the market has gone up 18% since the first inversion, but the clear difference today is that the Federal Reserve in particular is not raising interest rates any longer, and they're quite likely to cut interest rates. Well, that really suggests that the environment we have right now is a lot closer to what we had in 1998-1999 with Alan Greenspan talking about irrational exuberance but doing nothing about it until quite late in the cycle, rather than the inflation scare because of commodities outperformance that we had in 2006 and 2007, which forced or encouraged central banks to raise interest rates and then choked it off with the and eventually the collapse in oil prices. That was the other point, of course, is that oil prices were extraordinarily high back in 2006 and 2007. That's certainly not the case today. So we do have differences. I think it's also worth pointing out, this is not something that people tend to look at all that often, but when, for example, we look at the yield curve from back in 2000, we can see that it goes from top left to bottom right. So I think that's a clear inversion. It's inverted not just in part of the curve, but across the curve there's an inversion. Now if we look at the condition in 2007, it's a very similar condition. So these are what we might consider to be classic inversions of the yield curve, very much going from top left to bottom right. But then when we look at the yield curve as it is today, well, it's not the same. We have a belly in the curve, so there is certainly some pricing in of the potential for interest rate cuts in the short term, but it's still going broadly from bottom left to top right. So yes, we do have an inversion right now between the 3-month and the 10-year, and we have a very flat environment, the 10-year's somewhere over there, but we have a very flat environment between the 2-year and the 10-year. So what that does suggest is, yes, we've had the inverted yield curve, but there are mitigating circumstances right now to really suggest that this is something that needs to be urgently considered. I think the much more important point is that stock markets tend to go up and go up a lot following the first inversion of the yield curve. And we don't generally get a we don't generally get panicky environment in stock markets until we see a significant pop on the upside. It's when the yield curve spread starts to surge through 500 basis points. It's not simply enough to pop above it in a short period of time, but when it needs to in fact surge through 50 basis points, that's when stock markets generally take fright. So I think that's an important point here. Now, when we then consider where are we in terms of this cycle, well, just zooming into a daily chart, we had an impressive rebound on the S&P 500. And so far, this reaction was relatively similar sized to that posted in December and slightly smaller than the one posted in September, October. But what it now suggests is that the 3200 point level is the most recent of the higher reaction lows. And as long as that remains the case, we can probably give the benefit of the doubt to higher to lateral ranging or additional upside. The Nasdaq popped on the upside in here today and is now at a new all-time high. Part of the reason why the Nasdaq has outperformed the S&P 500 is because Tesla's not in the S&P 500, but it is in the Nasdaq 100. And the share was up $100 in here today. Now, this is climactic activity, and it does suggest that we've seen a peak of near-term significance. There was some profit-taking right in the last few minutes of trading. Definitely people looking at the $1,000 area and thinking, well, perhaps that might be enough. So it came back and finished up only $100 on the day, whereas it had been up almost $200 on the day. So what that suggests is we are probably approaching the end of what has been a stratospheric rise by Tesla. And it is really quite divorced from its fundamentals. That's regardless of the fact that it is likely to be a significant disruptor in the transportation sector, that it has probably an equal chance of becoming the first company to, in fact, deliver on level 5 autonomy. I would say the other contender is Google. Google announced earnings that were below expectations yesterday, and it pulled back initially and recouped much of the decline by the close in here today. But the most important thing it needs to do is to hold the breakout from that range that persisted for about 18 months. Apple has a very overextended trend as well, and it was in positive territory in here today. I think what we can clearly see here is that we do have higher reaction lows now, and that the trends up from the lows in August are still intact, but those progressions of higher reaction lows need to hold. There is still the potential that we could have a reversionary move, that there is a very wide overextension relative to the trend mean on a significant number of these shares, and inevitably we're going to get some kind of reversionary move eventually. Microsoft continues to push on the upside, and arguably it is now accelerating higher. And the overextension relative to the trend mean continues to be extended. What this is all supportive of is the view that we're still in a highly liquidity-driven environment. Then when we think about, well, where is that liquidity coming from? Well, the USA is continuing to run a $1 trillion deficit, and the Federal Reserve has been expanding the size of its balance sheet and is likely to continue to do so. The next update will be this week on how wide the balance sheet is now. They didn't do anything in January, and the pullback that we saw on Wall Street is pretty much pricing in the potential that they are going to do something this month. Then, of course, we have what's going on in China. And the Chinese administration has got a clear incentive to support the market. The Shenzhen, or the CSI 300, was up meaningfully in here today. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong was also up in a dynamic manner and is holding now the sequence of higher reaction lows since August and holding the 26,000 point level. In India, the Nifty index bounced emphatically from the region of the trend mean. I think this is one of the more important charts. The most consistent thing about the trend over the course of the last 2 years has been the failure of upside breaks to hold. The ability of the index now to bounce from the trend mean and to hold the majority of the advance is really quite positive. Now, when we look at Australia, obviously the market there is highly influenced by the outlook for China, and the resources sector should benefit from additional Chinese stimulus. The Australian dollar had been breaking down at the end of last week, but it was up half a point in here today. It's all pretty much unchanged, but this is an upside key reversal, I think, is probably the main point here. Well, when we look at these kinds of signals, where we had a very short-term oversold condition, now we're getting an upside key reversal. Upside follow-through tomorrow would greatly enhance the potential that we're going to see a rally back up towards the upper side of the range. And it's certainly confirming near-term support in the region of the lows. that's certainly supportive of the commodity complex. And the continuous commodity index has come back below 400, following a very sustained decline over the course of the last 3 weeks, but now it's right in the region of the trend mean. And if it can hold this level, then that will certainly help to reinforce the argument that the almost 18-month downtrend has in fact been broken. It's been led lower by the industrial resources, and the LME Metals Index is steadying in here today, but it had a much more pronounced decline. Copper prices were also right in the region of the lower side of their range, having given up all of the advance in here yesterday. Then we've seen a rebound in here today, and at least confirming near-term support in the region of the $2.50 area, which is the lower side of the range that's persisted now for about 18 months. Then, when we look at the oil price, West Texas Intermediate closed below $50 in here today, so it is following the Brent crude price downwards. The reality here is we're going to have to see some supply getting shut in, and that is something that OPEC hasn't really been able to announce just yet. They need to have a move that is going to clearly burn the shorts. But there is the additional point that in the event that they do not act, well, that is going to put even greater pressure on the US onshore unconventional producers, particularly those that are more highly levered. And that increases the scope that we're going to have bankruptcies in the US shale sector. That will probably result in weak hands giving way to strong hands. Certainly, there's been a great deal of private equity dry powder amassed in the clear intention of picking up these assets at attractive prices. So there is obviously going to be an opportunity there from the perspective of some of those private equity houses. If we look at the S&P 500 energy sector, it is still in a parlous state, right at the lower side of the range over the last year, but also in the region of the lows from 2016 and going all the way back to the lows put in around 2010. It's certainly got a short-term oversold condition. But the big question is, when are we going to see a low come in for the oil price? It's going to require a significant event in order to suggest that demand, on the one hand, is going to start picking up again, and that's probably not going to happen until China gets back to work, and that is going to be constrained by the quarantine efforts to try and avert a catastrophe in terms of the healthcare system there, which is already overloaded. So the requirement for additional liquidity is going to be, I think, really very considerable. That's the reason why the stock market continues to advance. That's the other important point about the yield curve spread. It has scared the central banks. Central banks today are trying their darndest to try and ensure the cycle persists, whereas there have been occasions previously that, following an inverted yield curve, they continue to tighten and choke off liquidity. So we're just not there yet. There is still the potential that we're going to see additional upside. Even in the short term, with overextensions relative to the trend mean, there is obviously the risk of some mean reversion. But the bigger picture is that the S&P 500 has had three 18-month consolidations over the course of the last decade. We've just ended the last one. On each of the other occasions, it rallied for upwards of 2 years. and it really hasn't been rallying for all that long. And that suggests that there is ample scope for continued upside, even with this short-term overbought condition. Then when we think about what's going on in the UK, we are quite likely to have additional volatility. But I think what's rather interesting is, despite the weakness in the pound yesterday and the steadier action we've seen in here today, so far this breakout from the three-year base has held, and it looks like a first step above the base. That suggests that we can certainly expect to see brinksmanship and a great deal of rhetoric. But the more likely scenario, or at least the market is continuing to give the benefit of the doubt to the UK, that the pound will not go back and make new lows. Of course, there is going to be a great deal of negotiation, and there is going to be nothing off the table. But it's quite likely that by the time we get to the end of 2020, a modest deal will be agreed. It probably take months to agree on what they actually agree on. And then the thornier issues will be pushed on to the next round. It's quite likely, I think, we're going to have a phase one deal and then a phase two deal between the UK and the EU. Perhaps the most significant factor is that Westminster is now wholly responsible to UK voters. They no longer have the option of blaming Europe for ineffectual pieces of legislation being passed. That aligns the interests of voters and those they voted for. And that return of sovereignty is, I think, by far the most impressive and encouraging sign that the UK does have the potential to achieve its potential. Its economic potential, its social potential, and its global potential. But of course, that is going to be dependent on governance, and that will be the true challenge of the new administration. I think with that I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.